Well, I don't know about my wisdom, but I am very confident in God's. So that's my prayer, that it is God's wisdom that we will come around today. I'm wondering if you've discovered your safe place. Christy asked us at the beginning of this series what our safe place was. And if you didn't get to hear her message, then today I'm asking you to think about what your safe place is. And the other thing is, have you found a safe place with Jesus? That's what we've been exploring. And I've been participating in the online chat a little bit. Good morning to online. I think it's amazing that we have a safe place where people can join with us online. And if that's you today, then I'd love you to pop in the chat, safe place. And if you've joined us today and you're new on this journey and you're just having a little explore, or maybe you're coming back after a while, our prayer is that this is a safe place for you to discover Jesus. Well, I had to think really hard when Christy asked the question, what was my safe place? And I've got a photo for you. This is a balcony that just is accessed from my bedroom. And I start most days that are pleasant enough with a coffee on this balcony. It's a beautiful way to start the day. I watch the birds with my husband. You might see some binoculars there. It's not creepy. We oversee a reserve, and we're on a hill, so we overlook Launceston, and so we use those for bird watching. We've recently been spotting the helicopters that are water bombing the fires on the opposite hill, behind Launceston on the east side. And you know what? I get to sort of step out of my life and watch the world go by. And we previously had a series called Pause My Life, and I do a lot of revisit, I do a lot of reflect, I do a lot of refocus on this balcony. And then it occurred to me, actually, I do a lot of devotion time. I spend a lot of time with Jesus on that balcony. So actually, it's Jesus that makes that my safe place. Because with Jesus, I don't have any shame for my failures, because he doesn't judge me. And I know that he knows me. And he knows the weakness, and he knows the vulnerability, and I know that he covers me, and he protects me. And I know that I just know that I am welcome with him all the time. And he enjoys my company when I'm not good company. Jesus' compassion is tuned into our souls. In his presence, there is absolute power and safety. He is both king and lamb. He has truth that we can build our lives on. And God's justice, wow, that's motivated by love. Where do we get to experience in our world justice motivated by love? We experience dichotomies of black and white thinking. And Jesus is not trapped by oversimplification of complexity. In him is the dichotomy of strength and vulnerability, divinity and humanity. And today, we we're going to focus on Jesus' humility. And I did a little bit of background research reading John Dixon's book, Humilitas. All things humility can be found in this book. And it was fascinating that he's a historian and he traced the origins of humility back to Jesus' time. Because the culture that Jesus came into is an honour-shame culture, and honour was built by dominance, power over the weak, status. But after Jesus' crucifixion, there is a clear paradigm shift where honour is connected now to helping the vulnerable and the weak and using power not for self but for the benefit of others. If you want to go deeper, I recommend reading this book. John's definition of humility is a willingness to hold power in the service of others. Look at Jesus. What was his position before entering creation? In the beginning was the Word is Jesus, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. Look at Jesus. The one who did the work of creation humbled himself to become part of that creation, not grasping for power like Adam and Eve and you and me, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking on the nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Look at Jesus. He holds his power in service of humanity. Consider this scene at Simon the Pharisee's house. A powerful, influential man surrounded by his friends who would, of course, have been collected to increase his status. Jesus is there invited, wondering if that's a boost to his status because he could get Jesus to his table. And we also see the woman of disrepute. Gets me thinking, what would I do in Jesus' position? And it occurred to me, my closest sort of approximation is festivale lunch. I am so fortunate to be gifted with a ticket to this event at Christmas time. And it's a small gathering, about 60 people, sells out in an hour. And it's the who's who of Launceston. I consider what I'm wearing for at least a week. And I thought about that event and I thought, what would I do if I'm seated at the table meeting the people around me? There's always 12 and you meet other people. And somebody that I've spent time with in one of our homeless accommodations saw me through the window and decided to come and spend some quality time. What would I do? It's not pretty. But look at Jesus. Can you see any difference in the way he responds to Simon and the woman? He's unconcerned by status. He turned toward the woman and he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman?" Oh yes, he really, really did. "I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, which was appropriate. But this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet." You see, Simon, who has disrespected Jesus, is treated by Jesus with the same level of respect as the woman who is looked down on, but yet has honored Jesus. And look at Jesus. He had that compassion on the multitudes, feeding the 5,000, having sacrificed a much needed retreat time, and they love him. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world, Jesus." Knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Look at Jesus. The crowd are adoring him, wanting to make him king, and he leaves to spend time with God. Gets me thinking, how would I go? It's a struggle. This is a different balcony shot. I'm not with Jesus. I'm not spending time with God. I'm lapping it up. Hey, I'm not alone in the struggle. You can laugh. The disciples needed lots of help too. This incident is recorded by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The people are bringing little children to Jesus. The disciples don't just, you know, shush them to the side. They rebuke them. That's not very nice, is it? Look at Jesus. He's indignant. And the word that Mark uses here is irked, exasperated. These are the final months of his ministry. He's been with this team for 3.5 years. He's exasperated by this issue with power and status. Look at Jesus. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Look at Jesus. On his final night with his team, impressing on them this example of humility, washing their feet. Look at Jesus in the last moments on trial. He stands silent. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The chief priests accused him of many things in his second trial. So again, Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they are accusing you of?" But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. This was not normal behaviour. He stands silent. Why? Why does he make no defence? Because he stood on trial for you and me, and we are guilty. He accepted the ultimate shame of crucifixion. Here is the greatest expression of power held in service of others. Our shame was nailed to that cross. Jesus' humility makes a safe place for us. I hope you are discovering that if you're new. I hope you are remembering that if you've known Jesus for a long time. Here's the kicker. Are we a safe place for others? Which one of us has not been in an argument or a dispute? What causes people to abuse each other? Where does divisions arise? Paul puts it this way: you are still worldly, for since there is jealousy and quarreling among you, are you not worldly? Are you not acting like mere humans? In one word, ego. Our ego is the cause of disputes. Tim Keller, in this really short, amazing book, The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, explains the imagery that Paul uses in his language around pride and human ego. And it's this image: bloated, overinflated, distended beyond proper size. It's active, always needing to draw attention to ourselves, comparing and boasting. It's painful. Our egos often hurt. It's empty at the center, because attempting to run our own lives and achieve our own sense of self-worth and find our own meaning in existence is emptiness. It's fragile. It's at risk of being deflated at any point. Pride is the pleasure of being more than the next person. The problem is it only takes a person more than us to come in the room and we're deflated. And I admit, I struggle. It's a constant tension to be managed, balancing these scales of overconfidence and no confidence. And the only way to get that balance is when I center myself on Jesus. Because Jesus' humility is a safe place for us, and our humility is a safe place for others. So how can we cultivate humility? It's an elusive beast. And if you think you have it, better think again. Here are five ways. Humility is thinking of yourself less, like Timothy Keller talked about, and thinking of Christ more. It's not thinking less of yourself. That's false humility or low self-esteem. It's not those things. My old self has been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. So I live in this earthly body by trusting in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Our ego needs to die. So no longer I live by my ego, but by the nature of Christ, clothed in his presence, his truth, his justice, his compassion, and his humility. Then we can express love and compassion more, because where there's more love, we see less fear. 2, humility is accepting our position in creation. As image bearers, we have a position of authority and power. As Jesse rightly said, when we join together, there is power in our position in creation. We're given that to rule over. Under God's direction and authority. Here's a dichotomy. We are rulers submitted. We need God's guidance. We have to understand our own limitations and recognize the value in joining together in community. For by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith God has distributed to each of you. So how do we get a sober estimate? Does it come from accomplishments in appearance or possessions, relationships? No. All those things are transient and unreliable. The more our self-worth depends on these things, the more crushing each failure, each loss, each defeat. So how do we gain this sober estimate? Well, David, King David, he orientated himself this way. When I consider the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet. So we ground ourselves, we get a sober estimate from the truth that is found in the Bible, the identity that God has written into our creation. This is solid. It fills that ego with something substantial that does not change with our successes or our failures, and we all have both of those. Where do you gain your self-worth? It's a good question for us to answer. 3, humility is accepting both our strengths and our weaknesses. I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. This is Paul writing to the Corinthians. Here we see the dichotomy of sin and innocence, and it's managed by Jesus, who was innocent and became sin on our behalf. In Christ, we are both broken and perfect. So now there is no condemnation for those who belong to Christ Jesus. See, criticism's not harmful when we don't put our sense of value in the opinions of other people. This is the place where we learn and we can grow, we can embrace new thinking, and we can make space for others to contribute authentically. Humility makes it safe to be wrong, to make mistakes, to receive correction and grow. Here's a quick humility test for us. How do you respond to feedback? Number four, humility is holding our power in the service of others. Look at Jesus. How does he treat the prostitute, the tax collector, the powerful, the influential, the leper, the multitudes, the children, the widow? Does he try to dominate or impress? Does he manipulate or threaten? Does he justify himself, prove his point? Does he overlook or avoid? We all have power in our circles of influence, in our families, in our friendships, in our workplaces, in our community. How do you use your power? Is it in service of others? And fifth and last point. Humility is treating those with whom we profoundly disagree with respect and friendship. Look at Jesus. He entered this sin-filled world. He walked among us. He treated sinful people like you and me with respect and friendship. He had compassion. He spoke truth. He loved. In Tim Keller's book, The Art of Self-Forgetfulness, we find a path to Christian joy. We need to take our egos to the cross, let them die, and be resurrected. Because when we're clothed in Jesus, in his presence, his truth, justice, compassion, his humility, and tonight when he talks about his reliability, wow. It's only through Jesus Christ can we be a door of hope in our fragile and uncertain world. We can be united in our mission to be Jesus-centered, so we can focus on other people, and we get to do that together in a safe community.